Good morning, I'm Edwina Farley and this is A Big Country here on RN. This week, a special story for all you dog lovers out there. Abandoned working dogs are finding new homes through a volunteer rescue scheme. We're harnessing solar power to run composting machines and a Childers couple confounds the critics by growing stone fruit in subtropical Queensland. It really shouldn't work, but it does. We'll also head to Albany in Western Australia, where Matt Wilson is living the dream. He's opening his own microbrewery.
Love my beer. Love my beer. There's nothing better than beer. Like I said, it's a working man and woman's drink. Most people finish their day of work and go, oh, I'd love a beer right now. And if it's a nice beer, a delicious beer, then yeah, that's the way to go. Love beer. It's beautiful.
Do you think you'd like a Chardonnay? Maybe not. Definitely a beer lover there. You'll hear Matt's story later in the program. But let's start today in a sheepyard in southern New South Wales, where abandoned working dogs are finding new homes.
That's Perry Chappell putting a two-year-old Kelpie called Jem through her training paces. Jem's one of 21 dogs that Perry's caring for at the moment. Hello, I'm Cara Jeffrey. Perry is one half of the working dog rescue team called Herd to Homes. Perry's based here on the family property at Deniliquin in southern New South Wales. Her business partner and fellow dog lover, Jenny Dryden, lives 800 kilometres away on the Central Coast. They've saved 527 abandoned working dogs and puppies since forming the group just over 12 months ago.
We're built on volunteers. We have 100 volunteers now, so we're nothing without them. So we rescue working bred dogs from pounds, shelters, RSPCA, and we also wanted to work more with farmers and just spread awareness and education that there's, you know, other ways to handle failed or unwanted workers, accidental litters.
When you get the call that there's working dogs in at the pound that have come in as little young pups, how do you go about that?
We rescue all across Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia. So when we are notified of a dog in need, a lot of it's done on social media, email, or yeah, phone calls. We put a call out to our volunteers and ask who may want to foster those dogs. And then most of the time we do have to arrange transport, whether that be, you know, volunteers linking up with a transport relay to get them to safety in their foster home or using commercial transport.
What are the condition of the dogs that you often do take in?
9 times out of 10 they have no training, so they'll jump all over you, they won't come when you call them, they just don't have any of the basics and have never had boundaries or training. So we start them off straight away on learning basic manners. A lot of them are mistreated, malnourished, injured. A lot of dogs get dumped when they're injured and people, I guess, can't afford to or don't want to fix the injury or illness.
Herd to Homes is all about finding the right home, not just any home for these busy and intelligent working dogs.
We are very picky in where we adopt our dogs out to because we don't want to just find a good home, we want to find the perfect home for each dog's needs. Puppies, we have no problem finding homes for them, and young adults sort of 3 to 5 to 6 year olds are pretty easy to place as well.
While Perry trains the dogs in the sheep yards and in the paddocks, Jenny concentrates on dog behaviour and dog psychology.
Jenny's really passionate about obedience and dog behaviour and psychologies, and she also does training and testing for dogs to be rehomed to corrective services, and they take on rescue dogs and put them through their program, and if they pass the training with corrective services then they go on to have a career as a drug detection dog, which is just fabulous because they, you know, they get to work every day, use their clever little minds, and then they go home with their handlers, and yeah, it's a wonderful life. And I think last month we sent another 3 off to corrective services and we had 2 that just past their training with them, so yeah, that's a great home for them as well.
And is that Kelpies that are going into that type of work?
Pretty much all the working breeds have the higher level of intelligence and drive that's needed for that. With the corrective services and the detection dogs, what we look for is ball drive, so they've just got to be really ball mad, focused on their ball, sniff it out and all that sort of thing, and that's sort of the first signs of then Jenny will coordinate with the carer to get them to run the dog through drills.
Hello babies, hello. How are we?
Yes, Roger. Hello.
Perry's kept pretty busy running herd to homes and caring for all these foster dogs, but she still manages to find time to help out on the family farm.
Well, first thing in the morning would just be replying to some emails, foster carer questions in our Facebook group and all of that. Maybe coordinating a couple of rescue saves or some transport. Then is, yeah, the half hour job of feeding all the dogs, cleaning up after them, checking they've got enough water, do some basic training with all of the dogs, just on their manners, and then just interact with them, throw the ball, play with them, cuddle them. You know, it's a pretty hard job having to cuddle puppies. then I'd probably do some more work on the computer before heading out with Jem and Roger and the other pups I'm testing on the sheep, and probably spend about an hour in the sheep yards doing that. Fit in some work for Dad there, carting some hay, changing some water. A lot of the time I'm on the road doing transport, rescue saves, things like that, and more office work, accounting. Visits to the vet, that happens some weeks I'm there every day. And then, yeah, nighttime feeding again. And if it's really hot, maybe later in the evening do some sheep work.
So we're just putting the sheep in the forcing yard to the drafting race. Sit, gate. And we've just been learning to clear the gate there. So she's just mastered that this week.
And Perry's putting these yard skills to good use. She and young Jem have started competing in working dog trials.
I've just started to get into the world of trialing, yard dog trials. So Jem and I entered in our first one a fortnight ago. I was more nervous than she was, but we made it through the course, which was our goal, and scored 80 out of 100, which was just amazing, far exceeded our expectations.
Now we'll put the sheep in the race.
Sounds like she's got plenty of promise there with the bark. How's she go? Do you think she's going to be a yard dog or a paddock dog?
Oh, she's naturally more of a paddock dog. She loves the space out there, and she'll just, I can cast her out as far as the eye can see, and she's brilliant out there, but she's growing in confidence in the yard now. She really didn't like tight spaces, like what I was talking about, the exercise of clearing the gate. She wouldn't do that because she'd have to push right in, and she's mastering it now and just starting to back as well. So yeah, I think she can do both. She is a pretty special dog, so I don't, yeah, dogs like her don't come up in the pound every day.
Jem, come to me. To me. Sit.
She was rescued from Cootamundra Pound at the start of June. I saw her pound photo and there was just something special about her. She came here pretty scared, untrusting, no confidence. You could tell that she had stock sense, but she just didn't do anything. She'd just hold the stock still all day. So I've done a few working dog schools, so that's been wonderful because we've been able to learn like sort of what we need to unlock her potential and keep working on it at home. She has come with me a couple times now to come and help drafting 3,500 sheep up at a property past Canargo, and just absolutely thrives, so confident and strong.
Jem, speak up. Good girl. Speak up. Speak up, Jem. Good girl. Good girl, speak up.
If you thought worms were the only way to make compost, then the sound of this machine might surprise you. G'day, I'm Marty McCarthy, and today I'm on a worm farm, not far from the Big Pineapple on Queensland's Sunshine Coast. I'm here to inspect what its designer thinks is an Australian first. It's a mechanical compost bin, powered by the sun.
It certainly is, yes. We are happy to say that it's been designed here in Australia, running entirely on solar.
Penny Mitchell is a worm farmer at Palmwoods. She's built this device in her backyard shed.
We've got the solar panels that you can see on the top there. You open the lid and there's a couple of barrels inside. You feed your waste, so your organic fruit and veg scraps, any scraps, compostable packaging, into one barrel. You can feed that for about a week until it's quite full, and then you start feeding the second barrel. Once the second barrel's very full, you can come back to the first barrel, which would be within sort of 10 to 14 days, and empty it out, and you've got a great compost that you can use on your garden.
Composting is something that people would normally assume is done by worms, but this machine doesn't need that. It just goes into the compost goes into these barrels. The barrels are rotated with the power of the sun, and that becomes the compost.
It does. So basically, the food waste or any waste that is breaking down actually produces bacteria that will heat it up to pasteurise it, so up to, you know, sort of 50, 60 degrees. So it breaks down fairly rapidly if you're heating it up and then aerating it, and then it heats again and aerates. So we don't put any external heat into it. It's all done by a natural process.
And who are your customers? Who's actually buying this technology?
So a lot of the people are obviously interested in their footprint, so their sustainability. But we also sell them to schools and universities that, you know, are educating the population to be much more aware of what happens with our waste at the end of its cycle.
But it's not just universities and schools where the solar power composter is being used. Sunshine Coast Airport has recently installed one too. General Manager Peter Pallett explains.
As part of our carbon accreditation program, we were looking at a way to introduce a third stream in terms of our waste minimisation. And OSCO is a locally made product. It's solar powered, and we're using it now to take all of the waste from our cafes and from our offices in terms of food. And so far, about 14,500 litres of that material has been treated and now in our gardens.
So you've nicknamed it OSCO, On-Site Composting Apparatus.
Certainly OSCO, of course, for those of my vintage, Sesame Street, lives in the bin, and OSCO's a great partner to us.
It's Kelvin Steele's job to look after the composter. Kelvin, what does that actually involve?
Feeding OSCO daily, sorting, getting the consistency right. It's like being a chemist, really, getting the wetness and taking the wetness out with some dry carbon neutral stuff like sawdust and paper. We just try and get a really good consistency and monitor it over the 2.5 weeks that it's in there until it's matured, until we take it out, and then we can start using that bin again. So we have two bins, so one gets full, we start emptying the other one, basically, and then we just keep going on like that. It's a bit of a process, and you just keep monitoring it.
It's quite ironic, Peter. A garbage truck has just showed up. Have you noticed, or do you not need as many of these vehicles arriving anymore to pick up your waste?
Oh, that's right, Marty. We've actually reduced significantly the amount of trucks that we have going to landfill, and we've had to double the amount of trucks that are now going to the recycle depot. And certainly the refuse area, it's much nicer smelling.
Once the waste matter has been broken down into compost, it will be sprinkled on surrounding gardens. OSCO is an important step in Sunshine Coast Airport's attempt to become carbon neutral. Penny Mitchell says as businesses like airports try to boost their environmental credentials, interest in her invention is growing.
Yeah, we're actually getting quite a bit of interest. We've had inquiries from India and New Zealand and a few other places. So I think that there's lots of potential in the future. Everybody's looking at climate change and being more responsible. So hopefully it's a thing of the future.
Penny, you're building these at the moment in your backyard shed. Are you going to have to expand if this becomes more popular?
We do like working from our backyard shed. We don't have far to go, but yeah, I guess scales, how many we'll be producing will dictate, you know, the size shed we need.
Penny Mitchell from Queensland's Sunshine Coast talking about her solar-powered composters with Marty McCarthy. Still to come on A Big Country Today, we're tapping into the thirst for craft beers with a distinct local flavour and growing surprise peaches in subtropical Queensland.
It absolutely shouldn't work. Avocados, yes. Macadamia nuts, yes. Sugar cane, of course. But the fruit that's sitting in this cold room waiting to go to market, well, it shouldn't be grown in commercial quantities here in subtropical Queensland.
Peaches there, we've got ready to take to markets this weekend. We just packed them up yesterday.
Hello, I'm Callie Buchanan. Teresa and Joe Winkler are confounding the critics by growing stone fruit on this small farm near Bundaberg. They've got 800 peach trees and 320 nectarines planted in their Bella Pesca orchard. For Joe, it's the culmination of a long love affair with the fruit.
I would have started back in the early 90s when all this low-chill varieties started coming out then. So this is all Californian varieties that came out.
And so, Teresa, when did you come onto the scene?
About 10 years ago, didn't I?
Yep.
Yeah, Joe and I met, and yeah, we had a little patch down at his parents, didn't we? How many did you have there? 500.
Oh, 500, yeah.
So I got involved picking them and learning about it.
After selling his southern Queensland farm and working in packing sheds around Queensland, Joe got a job at Childers, about an hour south of Bundaberg, but he couldn't leave the peaches behind.
An opportunity came up here for a part-time job, so I jumped at that, and while we were here, we sought block of dirt, water, peaches. Why not?
Now, you say it screams peaches, but on the hill over there, we've got sugar cane. Across the way, we've got macadamia nuts and avocados, all the things that Childers is known for. Peaches. Why peaches?
Something I know. Something I know, and no one else was growing it, because a lot of growers in the 90s that were growing have actually gone out of them to a certain extent. So the low-chill industry has probably dwindled a little bit. So I thought, perfect opportunity to go back into it.
And give it a go.
Give it a go.
Yeah, see if it works up here.
Yeah. Mm.
Does it work? Can you grow peaches in subtropical Queensland?
Yes. Yes, you can definitely grow them here. It's a little bit tricky sometimes, but you can grow them. You just got to select the right varieties that suit the area a little bit more, that's all.
Peaches and nectarines need a cold winter to tell the trees to crop, something that's in short supply in Queensland. But some, like the Californian varieties the Winklers grow, need fewer chill hours than others, and they've now successfully harvested their second crop.
I think growing them here has actually given them better flavour. I think it might be, I put it down to the soil. The flavour's beautiful here for this variety. Different other varieties you have to experiment with a little bit and see how they go.
What are some of the challenges you face here?
Getting used to growing them on good soil, basically. That's probably the hardest thing, because that was one of the biggest problems I had, was vigorous, strong growth. And I had to actually try and slow the tree down a bit by pruning harder, a lot more pruning work involved in them. But basically that's probably about the biggest challenge. The weather conditions, this year's a bit funny, but next year could be completely different. You can't do anything about that. You just got to run with that one.
While the first crop went to the wholesale market, this year Teresa decided to take the fruit direct to customers, selling at local markets. The response has been overwhelming, and she's even using the second's fruit to make jams.
Just so people can taste them. I don't like it if they can't taste them fresh, because they're so beautiful when they're fresh. Everyone deserves to taste that, don't they? Yeah. And we just keep plodding along, and we've got to plant some, if I keep making jam, we've got to plant some lemon trees. And we've got to plant a passion fruit vine, because the peach and passion fruit jam, everyone seems to love that. So we'll have to plant some passion fruits, and we'll just plod along and just keep going and see what happens. Yeah, but that's what we're sort of working towards. Yeah.
And those consumers that you do now get to meet at the markets, what's their response to your fruit?
They love them, don't they? They'll have a taste, and they'll come back and say to us, they're beautiful, and it's almost surreal. Like, we think, yeah, they're nice. Are they that nice? But their response has been amazing. And the little kids, especially little kids. And then the lady at the markets, she said she hadn't tasted a peach this good since she was in Greece in 1998.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, that's so nice. It's surreal. We just here thinking, wow, you know, we knew they tasted good, but everyone's really been so supportive. It's been great. Yeah,
I think one of the biggest things is this variety we're growing. It's one of the early ones that came out, and it's a good eating peach. And the trouble is, these days with the marketing system, they're all asking for these new varieties which are hard, sit on the shelf for 3 weeks or sit in a cold room for 3 weeks, but then when you pull it out, it tastes like cardboard. Where if you get them fresh, everything tastes a lot better, in these especially.
So this stays at like 1 degree, 1.5 degrees. So this is like a big keg pretty much, that pressure vessel.
I love making beer. Beer's fantastic. It's a nice icebreaker. People enjoy it. You can sit down and have a good beer and talk with your friends. And then also love the process of making beer as well. That's really cool.
Matt Wilson could be described as the ultimate jack of all trades. He's worked as a boilermaker, fabricator, on computers, in an abattoir, and in the oil and gas game. And then one day he made a decision to throw it all in. And now, aside from being a husband and a dad, he goes by just one job title, brewmaster.
So
yeast is alive. It's actually a fungus, like mushrooms.
So I was working fly in, fly out. Little kids, I've got three beautiful little girls and my wife, and it's not really a fantastic lifestyle for little kids. And then we'd moved back from up north, and I started as just a home brewer. Was really enjoying that. Did the mandatory tin beers at the start and got used to cleaning fermenters and that kind of stuff. And then actually my cousin Leon from Geraldton had won a few awards at the Perth Royal Beer Show, and he was doing all grain, and he kept bringing me these beers down, and I was thinking, these are lovely beers. How do I go about that? So looked into it and started making some beers and did maybe 10 batches and then thought, here we go, I've got a good idea. Let's bring some good beer to Albany. And then it just snowballed from there.
The yeast will start to grow, so that's in its growth phase. You see, it'll start to get like a head on the top. That's called your crowsing.
Hello, so I'm Michelle Stanley. Matt set up a microbrewery in a converted nursery in Albany on the very south coast of Western Australia. He's hoping to tap into the growing thirst for boutique craft beers with a distinctive local flavour. And to do that, he's experimenting with local produce. We're talking strawberries, apples and honey, and even seafood like mussels and oysters.
So just off the bat, we're moving like, probably 12 to 15 kegs a week.
How important is local ingredients when it comes to something like this?
The majority of beers are based around a certain produce element, and that's why the beer was created, because people would have strawberries and say, okay, well, let's make a strawberry beer that works really well together. And beer works surprisingly well with so much produce, and it goes really well with food. What's in your beer you can be eating at the same time, which is really cool. So the local produce aspect is, it kind of ties all the flavors in for that area. You know, if we're pulling peaches from America and trying to make a peach whatever beer, it's not going to be the same as getting, you know, delicious fruit from down this way, which is, it's just the climate as well. We find the produce, especially in the southwest, is very flavoursome, has its own defined flavour, and that works really well for our beer. And then also the brewery ethic of being a microbrewery. We want to tie in as much local stuff as we can. Ultimately, we would love to have everything, all of the produce in the beers grown locally here. There was a massive industry a while ago, 50 to 100 years ago. There was a big industry for beer, and then it kind of dropped by the wayside as large commercial companies took over, and then it's just starting to come back. That microbrewery, probably the process side is what holds it up and takes a bit of time. People need to see that there's a market for their produce in that, so that they'll spend more money to process what we need to go into the beer. When our barley is purchased from within WA, the hops are from Victoria and Tasmania. We would love to have those things available in Albany, and they are starting to. People are starting to get there, so the more beer we can make and get out there and build a profile for it, yeah, the bigger those industries, follow-on industries, will get, which would be fantastic. That's our goal. To keep it local, we want to employ local people, use as much local business as we can, and yeah, just build it local. A brewery is great for that, and you can have a beer at the end of the day.
Carbonation stone, and then we inject it with carbon dioxide to give it that fizziness, give it that nice bubbly. Got all testing equipment to make sure it's at the right bubbliness.
You mentioned there aren't too many people doing what you're doing around the Great Southern. Do you think that's going to change? Do you think people are going to start things like this a little bit more?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think as the craft beer, boutique beer thing's taken off, Margaret River is around that area, is really big. I think they're looking 15 to 20 microbreweries there. So yeah, it's definitely taking off. It's definitely taking off. We get a lot more tourists coming through, and that all comes back to having that local produce and making fresh beer in a town, and people have access to fresh, delicious beer instead of pre-packaged stuff coming from overseas or interstate. So, and I think definitely people vote with their feet and go where there's good product, and they enjoy it. People like to know where their produce comes from. Same as beer, same with food. They want to know who's made it, where it's come from, what's gone into it. And I think that's a big aspect of that as well.
Then the kegs will head out the back into the cool room. They'll sit there for a week or so to condition, just let the flavours kind of meld together. And then they're pretty much ready for sale.
Sweet.
You still love your beer?
Absolutely. Love my beer. Love my beer. There's nothing better than beer. Like I said, it's a working man and woman's drink. But beer goes through every level of society. There's pretty much most people finish their day of work and go, oh, I'd love a beer right now. And if it's a nice beer, a delicious beer, something that people can follow along with, then yeah, that's the way to go. Love beer. It's beautiful.
Beer lover Matt Wilson, living the dream by opening his own microbrewery in Albany in Western Australia. And he was speaking there with Michelle Stanley. Thanks to Oren Gerassi for technical production this week. You can join us anytime to have a listen to the program via the ABC Radio Player app. I'm Edwina Farley, back with you next week.